Welcome to the Tech Policy Podcast. I'm Evan Schwartzdraber. On today's show, Secret Law. When Edward Snowden revealed information about U.S. surveillance programs, the public was outraged. But what might surprise many Americans is that Congress was in the dark, too. How do we have a situation where our elected representatives don't even know what's going on? Can a law be secret and still be enforced? Isn't that kind of an oxymoron? Joining me to discuss this is Liza Goitein, co-director of the Liberty and National Security Program at the Brennan Center for Justice. Liza, thanks for joining the show.
My pleasure.
So you guys have a report out about secret law, and that's what we're going to discuss today. But just to start the show, what do you mean exactly by secret law?
Sure. And that's an excellent question because it's not self-explanatory. It is very counterintuitive. So it's important to define the term. Well, by law, to start with, even something like law is not necessarily obvious. I mean, there are statutes passed by Congress. That's what most people think of probably when they think of law. But there are also binding opinions of courts. And it turns out there are a lot of other binding opinions as well that are issued by the executive branch. There are agency rules and regulations. So there's any number of different kinds of law. What I mean by law in this report is essentially any rule or legal interpretation or legal opinion that sets a binding standard for conduct by government officials. And what I mean by secret, again, this it sounds like it should be pretty straightforward, but it's really not because there's no such thing as a law that's 100% secret that literally only one person knows because that wouldn't do any good.
Right.
So the question is really how many people know and are they in one branch? Are they in two branches? Are they in all branches? And do they at some point reach the public? And basically any law that was withheld from the public, I treated as secret for purposes of this report because I found that the kinds of oversight that the other branches are supposed to provide for secret law don't actually work very well. And so a lot of the harms that flow from secrecy might be mitigated a little, but they're still there even when the other branches are aware.
So who does know what's going on if not people like you and me or our elected representatives? I did a previous show with Nathan Lemer and Daniel Schumann from R Street and Demand Progress, respectively, and they talked about how unless you're on one of the really special select committee on intelligence, you don't know that much. And even if you are on that committee, you might not know that much. So who does know if it's not 100% secret? Who's got this information? Who's being bound by this law? Who's interpreting this law? Who does this even apply to?
So that's a bunch of different questions you asked there, and they're not all the same thing. So there are cases, and for example, the NSA's warrantless wiretapping is a good example, where the law that governed that program, and I'm using law in quotes, you can't tell that because you can't see me, but imagine air quotes around the word law. The law that was used to govern that program was essentially legal opinions that were authored by a very small number of people in the Department of Justice and the White House working together. And the people who implemented the program that was governed by that law in the NSA were not allowed to see those opinions and were not allowed to know what the law was. So secret law can be known only by a handful of people, not necessarily even the people who are meant to follow that law. So right there, you can start to see some of the problems that arise.
Yeah, and it's not always it's interesting you bring up that point because the Patriot Act is an example where Congress passed the law. The text was public. In theory, you could go read it, but then the implementation was not necessarily what the law required because one of the co-authors, Jim Sensenbrenner, said, if I had known this is how it was going to turn out, I never would have voted for this. And then you have the legal opinions. And it seems like there's separation between the people writing the bill, the people implementing the bill, and the people deciding whether what's happening is actually legal. Does it make sense for those three groups to not be working from the same information?
No, it makes no sense at all. And it certainly doesn't make sense for the public to have access to one form of law or one statement of law that, as it turns out, really wasn't being followed, and that was the published Patriot Act. And then there's another set of rules, which are the rules that the FISA court agreed to sanction that were completely different from the published law. And so the law the government was actually following in that case, which really was the interpretations issued by the FISA court, was not only secret, it was inconsistent with the published law, so that instead of informing the public as to what the law meant and what the government could do or couldn't do, the published law was actively misleading the public about what could be done.
So there are many reasons to object to secret law. You lay them out in your report. One of them is the basic philosophical argument that laws need to be public in order to have scrutiny and morality and legitimacy, right? There, it's the basic point you made where how can people be bound by something they don't know exists? But is this even constitutional, right? Like getting aside or setting aside the whole philosophical argument and about values and about whether you're a civil libertarian or not, is this constitutional?
There are very strong arguments that it's not constitutional. A court has never had to rule on that express question. It would be very hard to even figure out how to get that question in front of a court for a number of reasons. There is a First Amendment doctrine of public access to government information. Unfortunately, the courts have seemed to limit that doctrine to access to the courts, access to judicial proceedings. There's not a lot of sense behind that limitation because the rationale for this reading of the Fourth Amendment is that access to judicial proceedings has a long tradition in this country and also is very beneficial to the working of the judicial system. And you could make exactly those same analogous arguments to other kinds of secret government information. But in addition to the First Amendment, there are some scholars who have put forward some very interesting structural arguments for why the Constitution should be read to require the law to be public. And essentially, there are a number of provisions in the Constitution that suggest that the legislature was intended to operate openly, with only, you know, extremely limited exception, whereas the executive branch, it was conceived, might be operating in secret. And so the sort of dichotomy that you see in the constitutional structure is that the law should be public, but the implementation of the law might occasionally have to be in secret. Now, that was back when the legislature was pretty much the only body making the laws. That has changed with the rise of the administrative state. The executive branch makes law. The executive branch makes law more often and in greater quantities than the legislative branch does. But that constitutional principle should still apply, that the making of the law and the laws themselves should be public.
So secret law is clearly a problem that is tied to national security and foreign policy, but this is the Tech Policy Podcast. So you and I both work in tech policy. Why is this a particular problem for the issues that we deal with in tech?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. And what I would say is that I think that the issues that are coming up in tech are presenting these novel questions. They are testing the boundaries of existing law. They are testing even what the Constitution contemplated. And so there's a lot of area to sort of break new legal ground. And when that's happening, it is absolutely vital that the public be able to see what's happening, because we can't rely on the dusty old volumes of the U.S. Code to tell us what's happening. So I think tech policy is one of the areas where transparency and democratic participation in the lawmaking process is most important. One of the problems with secret law is that it tends to be bad law. The quality of it tends to be poor.
Is that because of a lack of scrutiny, because there's no one around to improve it?
It's that. It's the fact that the people who are making these laws are not getting input from stakeholders and experts outside the government. And it's because it's much more likely that these laws are going to be influenced by groupthink or institutional biases. And in the tech field, you know, the experts in technology, I hate to say it, they're not in the government.
No.
I mean,
they don't get paid enough if they work for the government, frankly, in many instances. I mean, you can get a lot better working arrangements and work with a lot cooler equipment if you remain in the private sector.
Yeah. Well, and we need those people helping to inform what should be in these laws.
And a lot of those people don't necessarily have security clearances. I know there are a lot of tech experts who are not comfortable with the current situation, so they don't want to apply for a security clearance. So that really limits who's able to come to the table. What can be done about this stakeholders problem? How can you improve a law if you can't see it? And even if we're not necessarily talking about reform, which might come later, what are the first steps to just opening the black box so that someone like you, who's writing a report about secret law, could look at it and then apply some of the lessons you learned from the report?
Well, there needs to be a change in the way that we look at legal authorities and the way that we treat them under the national security framework. I mean, part of the problem is that the legal framework for classification is set forth in an executive order. Every administration, I think, except for Bush 41, has issued its own executive order governing classification policy. And that order doesn't distinguish between legal authorities and other kinds of information. And that doesn't make a lot of sense because the constitutional concerns that are implicated by secret law and the harms that flow from secret law are just different. They're different in kind and in degree from the harms that can flow from classifying other kinds of information. So I think the first step, and this isn't an easy one, is to revise a legal framework for classification so that law is treated differently, and that it really should be classified only, if at all, I should say, only in the rarest and most compelling cases of necessity.
And it's important to know how we got here, right? So I mentioned at the beginning of the show that there was a lot of outrage about government surveillance after the Snowden revelations, but overclassification and secret law was not invented in 2013, right? So how did we get to this point? Maybe it started with Bush, but feel free to go back even further if the history requires it. But just give listeners an idea of how we got from, you know, the basic assumptions about due process and the Fourth Amendment and things like that to these gray areas we have today, where it looks like the Constitution is regularly being at least challenged by pushing the envelope.
Sure. Well, this isn't the first time in America's history that we've been facing the problem of secret law. There have basically been three different periods or different challenges, systemic challenges to transparency of the law in the course of the country's history. And I should say this is against a backdrop of a pretty healthy commitment to transparency in the law, certainly compared with other nations and certainly compared historically. At the time that the United States at the time that our nation became a nation,
incorporated,
whatever it's called, basically a commitment to the transparency in the laws was a hallmark of this country from the beginning, and that was very different from other countries and from history, frankly, world history. And so that is something I think that, you know, our country can be proud of. But there have been three times during our country's history that this has been challenged. And the first challenge was really right off the bat, and that was simply the logistics of getting the laws printed and distributed. I mean, today that seems easy. You just stick them online. But that back then, making the law accessible to the public was no easy feat. And no. It actually took several decades for that to happen. And it wasn't really until the establishment of the GPO, the General Printing Office, Government Printing Office, that this was more or less accomplished, that the public could access the laws. The second challenge came in the next century in the form of the rise of the administrative state. And once you had federal agencies just multiplying and proliferating and enacting regulations and adjudicating administrative cases, you suddenly had this body of administrative law that hadn't existed before, and there was no mechanism to make this law public because it basically happened before the rules were put in place to make sure that it was public.
That's interesting because, you know, small government folks and Republicans and conservatives love to rail against the growth of government because of things like the welfare state and regulations that impact the economy. But you're suggesting that there's this maybe less noticed effect of just the New Deal and the growth of government and federal agencies and bureaucracy that people were not able to keep up with this growing power of the executive branch. And, you know, it's not just Congress that makes laws, it's regulators, it's judges. I mean, there's a lot of people legislating these days, right?
Absolutely. And the executive branch now, just by sheer volume, makes, probably orders of magnitude more law than Congress does. So these very people who were concerned about agency overreach and about regulations were pushing in Congress to make sure that these laws, these regulations would be transparent and that the rulemaking process would be transparent and would involve public participation. And that's why we have the Federal Register Act. That's why we have the Administrative Procedure Act. That's ultimately why we have the Freedom of Information Act. And essentially, these laws that were passed to ensure transparency in the administrative process more or less solved the problem of secret law arising from the administrative state itself. But no sooner had that happened than we encountered another challenge, and that's the rise of the national security state.
And this is as a result of 9/11. I mean, we're...
No, I'm going all the way back to after World War II. I mean, that's really, if the history of the national security state dates back to 1947, which is when the National Security Act was passed, and that basically fundamentally reorganized the military and intelligence structures in the United States and created the National Security Council. And that was the beginning of the executive national security state, and that was the beginning of the classification regime, the formal classification regime, and all of the national security secrecy that went with it. And that created a challenge to transparency of the laws of a different kind. That was the first time that the law was concealed deliberately. So the concealment that happened as a result of logistical problems with distribution and as a result of not having a federal register yet established, those were accidental. And those were solved through the GPO, through legislation. The national security-driven secret law is deliberate.
So that's this. We're really starting to see this in the second half of the 20th century. And I did bring up 9/11. Certainly, that probably accelerated this to an extent in the more high tech era. So fast forward to the Bush administration, which is really the start of a lot of these battles over electronic privacy. We had this whole debate over torture, and it's on the books. It's illegal to torture in the United States. Yet the government said what they were doing with waterboarding was not torture. Who was deciding whether waterboarding was torture? Who was deciding whether that was against the law?
A guy named John Yoo, some individual lawyers in the Department of Justice working with a few other people in the White House made the decision that the laws that and unambiguously prohibit torture should be construed to allow it. And they did it through a series of opinions that were issued by the Office of Legal Counsel within the Department of Justice. These opinions have the force of law in the sense that they are binding on the entire executive branch unless or until they are overruled by a court. And as we've seen, courts in this country don't get to rule on torture lawsuits, apparently.
And one of President Obama's or then candidate Obama's big things in his 2008 campaign was running against torture, running against warrantless surveillance, pledging to be the most transparent administration in history. Did that happen?
Well, the torture memos were made public. And I think a lot of people who had only really heard of secret law in the context of the torture memos, or maybe also the FISA court opinions, probably assumed that the problem was over with Obama or that that chapter of our history was behind us because Obama did release a lot of the OLC opinions. And he also, well, I shouldn't say he, the FISA court opinions have become much more transparent since Snowden.
Yeah.
And so, you know, a lot of people probably think that that the problem is over, which is one of the reasons why I wanted to write this report. The truth is there's still a lot of secret law, even in those very areas. I mean, we found that there are at least 74 OLC opinions from the Bush era between 2002 and 2009 on issues relating to the war on terror that no one has seen that are still classified. And we also learned that there are between 25 and 30 FISA court opinions that the Attorney General has deemed significant that are still classified that we haven't seen. And we also wanted to make sure that we underscore that the problem of secret law is much broader than just OLC opinions and FISA court opinions, which are the manifestations most people know about. This problem includes unpublished agency regulations, secret presidential directives, even classified provisions of law enacted by Congress, as well as many other types of law. One of the most surprising things we found in the report was the amount of secrecy in binding international agreements. We obtained documents from the State Department in litigation. We had to see them because the State Department doesn't actually respond to all your requests.
Yeah, surprised they didn't just, you know, you send them an email, they give you the classified documents.
Right, I don't know why that didn't happen. But we didn't want classified documents, actually. We said redact all the classified stuff. We just want to know how many international agreements have not been published because they're classified. We were able to determine, ultimately, that there were 807 international agreements between the U.S. and other countries between 2004 and 2014. That were not published. And that's actually 42% of all of the agreements entered into during that period.
So is there a good reason for why we got here? I mean, you know, Americans are very concerned about terrorism. We had 9/11. Clearly, there was an imperative to give law enforcement the tools they need to keep us safe. And is there a danger? A lot of people criticized Edward Snowden for what he did because classified information was given to journalists who didn't necessarily have the know-how to decide what could be field operations, what could be sensitive information that disrupts American intelligence activities. This is about striking a balance, right? Now, is there a danger in the transparency you're advocating for? Is there a danger that the NSA won't have the room it needs or that our enemies will learn things about us that we don't want them to know? I mean, where is the opposition? Is this just agencies don't want to give up information if they don't have to, that no matter what, they will try to withhold everything, whether it's your local police department or the NSA? Or are there legitimate policy reasons that you've heard when you go to the Hill and you try to talk about this? What are the best objections to what you're advocating for?
I think the reason why you see resistance to that is because secret law is a very convenient tool. Again and again, we have seen that secret law is how the government legalizes conduct that the public wouldn't agree with or that is inconsistent with the published law.
Or our values, too.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And so if the government wants to engage in contact of that, if the government wants to engage in conduct of that nature, secret law is how the government does it. And, you know, we live in a very legalistic society. Executive officials are, I mean, I guess this is the good news, but they're not going to rush off and torture people or, you know, tap their phones without a warrant unless they have some legal cover. And so that's why there are these legal opinions. And, you know, not all of them are as shocking as opinions that say that torture, you know, is just fine. I mean, some of them may be much less dramatic in their impact. Maybe the amount that the legal interpretation strays from the published law is maybe a bit smaller. But nonetheless, if it's going to be too difficult to persuade Congress or whoever else to change the law through the democratic process, then secret law is a very useful tool. Now, that's not to say that there are zero national security justifications for secret law. Those justifications tend to be much, much less persuasive when you're talking about the law than other kinds of information. There's a big distinction between national security operations, which often have to be secret, and these are the details like names of targets
Of course,
right. or sources or times or places of operations. Yes, absolutely, these have to be secret. But the law that governs these operations, if you're talking about rules, general rules that set general standards, almost by definition, these are not going to include the names of targets or times or places. They're going to be more general and not reveal that level of detail. If you're talking about legal opinions, which apply the law to the facts of particular cases, absolutely, you might have situations where those facts are sensitive.
But you could maybe redact those specific facts while still allowing the public to kind of see the logic that the court has applied. Would there be a benefit there of kind of splitting that baby and saying, look, public doesn't need to know any of the specifics of the case, but just the logical conclusion of the judge might be helpful to know?
The argument has always been that the legal analysis and the facts are too intertwined, too inextricably intertwined to make public any sort of meaningful redacted version. And I actually think there's been something to that argument because of the way these opinions have been written. They've been written with absolutely no effort to disentangle the facts and the law.
Right. If that's not what you want to do in the first place, you can just intentionally write an opinion where everything is completely jumbled together and then just throw up your hands and say, well, it would be just too difficult. But I mean, really, we're talking about formatting a freaking Word document. Like, separate that section, put it over here, put this section over there, and then, I mean, how how hard is this really?
Well, I do think that much can be done to write the opinions in a way that facilitates redaction and release. And we've seen that ever since the USA Freedom Act was passed that required the Director of National Intelligence and the Attorney General to release redacted versions or summarized versions, if necessary, of significant FISA court opinions. Those opinions have come out, and they've come out with redactions, but they've been readable, they've been comprehensible. The legal analysis has been there for people to see, and so it can be done. I mean, we've seen proof of concept. You know, I'm not going to say that there's never going to be a case where you really can't separate out the legal analysis from the facts, and I'm not going to say that there's never a case where a rule could actually get so granular in terms of what it allows or doesn't allow that it gives away the details of operations. What I am saying is we have to weigh the harm that comes from a system that gives great discretion to classify laws in those cases. What I am saying is that we have to weigh the harms to democracy that flow from having a system where there is discretion for the executive branch to decide which laws can be withheld and which laws can't be withheld, against the chance that there may be some cases at the very margins where there could be some form of national security harm from making the law public.
Yeah, and that gets to the trade-offs of just deciding to live in a free society in the first place. If you want 100% security, there are plenty of autocratic regimes out there that will promise you 100% security and maybe not even deliver.
I think that's a bridge that could be crossed at a later time. I think for now, I don't think we have to make this global decision of, you know, can we tolerate secret law at all, yes or no? I think there's plenty that could be done short of saying, well, you know, we either have to prohibit it or let things keep going the way they are now. That could help to rein in secret law. And that's why in the report, we have a lot of suggestions for things that could be done to very, very strictly limit and greatly reduce the amount of secret law without actually recommending a complete prohibition on it.
So you mentioned that so much of this happens at the executive level. Of course, a president with a privacy mind could just with a stroke of a pen change a lot of this stuff. Donald Trump's a big wild card on tech policy, but based on appointments and his rhetoric around surveillance, maybe holding out hope that there will be some executive orders there. Not so wise, but there's, of course, Congress, and there's been a lot of talk about Congress reasserting its role in policy within an experienced president-elect. Are there efforts in Congress to reform secret law?
There are. I mean, there are efforts to reform secret law. There are certainly very specific efforts around OLC opinions. There was a successful effort in 2015 around FISA court opinions, as I was discussing. And there are certainly members who are interested in the subject on a broader level. Classification generally, overclassification and classification reform, is something that Congress is paying more and more attention to. And there was a hearing just yesterday in the House on that subject. So I do think there will be some interest from Congress. And Congress has a strong interest in this. You know, Congress had trouble getting the information it needed under the Obama administration. And I can't imagine that the members are going to be happy with the amount of secrecy that they may see coming from the executive branch under this next administration.
Well, we'll leave it there. We linked to the report in the show notes for today, so make sure to check that out. My guest has been Liza Goitein, co-director of the Liberty and National Security Program at the Brennan Center for Justice. Liza, thanks so much for joining the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
Follow us on Twitter and Facebook. Let us know what you think of the show. Send us an email at media@techfreedom.org. Find this podcast in the iTunes store. Please leave us a review because it will help others find the show. Thanks for listening.
Podcast is produced and distributed by Tech Freedom, a nonpartisan, nonprofit think tank in Washington, D.C. To learn more about our work, make a tax-deductible donation, or find other episodes, find us online at techfreedom.org.